Okay. I think that's working. Welcome to the show, Seth.
Good to be here.
Yeah, first ever recording in the wall tent. So
yeah, that's really nice.
Yeah, it's warm, man. I've recorded in some neat places, and I've always wanted to record in the wall tent. So welcome. Sweet, we're making it happen. Earlier today, like, there was all this condensation in here, so I had to, like, beat off all the... dripping down on us here through the interview, but I think the electronics... I was just worried about the electronics, but I think they'll be okay, so... and the audience will probably hear the crackling of the wood stove in the background, because that's how we're keeping warm, so... Yeah, thanks for joining me. Tell the listeners who you are and what you do, and, we'll start there, and then we'll get into some of the canoeing you've done.
Yeah, I'm Seth Watton. I'm a paddler, and I just really love paddling since I was a kid. And I think it came from, oddly enough, in a roundabout way, my grandmother. She was very, like, she was a farmer and a very on-the-land type. Mm-hmm. And I remember going to visit her when I was a kid, like a toddler, when she lived in Barrie, Ontario, which later became like this metropolis, like very fast growing city.
Yeah.
But at that time, it was still pretty rural.
Yeah.
And I'd go to visit her, and we'd like pick carrots out of her garden and eat them fresh. And then we'd go on these nature hikes all around her place. And, cross train bridges, and she'd, you know, put her ear down to the track, making sure that the train wasn't coming and it was safe to go and right. Go swimming in the creek and stuff like that. So I think that really instilled a love of nature in me, which is sort of like where the whole interest in paddling came from.
Yeah.
And it was funny. I watched Sesame Street back in the day, and I think I was about 3 years old, and I saw that Big Bird went to this camp where, you know, they stayed in cabins and they were on a lake, and it was in the middle of the bush somewhere. And so anyway, from that point onwards, I kept persisting and asking my parents, like, I want to go to camp like Big Bird. And they were like, oh, okay. They didn't really know anything about that sort of thing. My mom sort of rebelled against her upbringing and was, you know, a very urban person.
Right.
And so they sent me to a day camp, and they said, oh, yeah, you're going to camp. It's going to be a lot of fun. And then I got there, and it was like in the city.
Oh.
There were some little patches of trees that looked like a part of a forest, but open fields. We went swimming in the pool, and I went, oh, well, yeah, it's really fun, but it, like, that's not the kind of camp that I was thinking of. And so, you know, I just kept persisting and hassling them about it, and they didn't know anything about it, and finally looked into it and sent me to camp when I was 6 years old.
Early.
So a residential summer camp.
Yeah.
And that really helped, like, propel my love of nature and expose me to canoeing. And I wasn't necessarily the strongest canoeist or someone who could carry all the big packs and canoes on the portages. I was a bit of a late bloomer out of my cohort. So kind of the scrawny guy, you know.
Right.
But like, I just loved being out there. Like, canoe trip was my favorite part of the summer.
Yeah.
And as I became a teen, I started doing more of that kind of thing on my own, paddling trips and backpacking trips. And then had an opportunity to work at a different residential summer camp.
Mm-hmm.
And took that, and I ended up working there for, I think it was 13 years, roughly, on and off.
Cool. Yeah, summer camps are such a training ground, aren't they, for paddlers in this country? Like, I know so many people who the love of paddling came from the, like, those 1 week trips you do at summer camp or those 2 week trips you do at summer camp. It's cool. It's like an institution that I'm happy exists, you know?
For sure.
I never did it. But lots of friends I have got into paddling that way.
But you did scouts, right?
Yeah, I was lucky to be in scouts, which I think scouts is one of those things, like, it can kind of suck if you have a bad, what do they call scouts? Pack of cubs. I forget what they call, like, a group of scouts. But if you have, like, a good group, it's awesome. And if you have a bad group that just cares about, like, acquiring badges and stuff, like, that's probably less fun. But we were out doing big, big trips. And that's how I got into it and, you know, still love it today. It's like, once you get into it, it's everyone's hooked, you know, like, yeah. So scouts is similar, but yeah, camps and scouts, they're just, yeah, such amazing. It's like a good way to get in. It gets so many kids into paddling who otherwise would not be exposed to it, I think.
For sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So how do you get from there? Like, well, I guess maybe I know how you get from there. It's like doing a trip every summer, but then to paddling across the country, which is really one of the reasons I was so interested to have you on the show is, I mean, that's such a huge trip, Seth. And you're now the second guest I've had on who's paddled across the country. So, like, yeah, maybe explain your trip a little bit and how you, what inspired you to think to yourself, I'm gonna do this. Yeah.
Well, I remember the first time the idea was kind of seeded in my head. It wasn't something I thought I was gonna do, but I had this trip leader when I was younger, Frank Wolf, who you've probably heard of.
Frank Wolf is your trip leader?
Yeah.
No way.
On a couple of trips, at least. No and he way. Was sort of legendary at our camp.
Cool.
For, you know, just being like a pack horse.
Mm-hmm.
And he would, you know, we saw him, like, put a pack, a big canoe pack on his back, another one on his front,
and then a canoe,
and like pick up a canoe and put that up and run to the other end of the portage, and he'd be running back to, you know, the beginning of the portage and pass us along the way to go and like double back and get other things. So anyway, when I became a CIT, a counselor in training,
mm-hmm.
he wasn't back there. I think it was around that time. And, I heard that he was paddling across Canada. I was like, what? You can do that? That's crazy. And I guess as I got into the camp guiding myself over time, I started doing other trips on the side, longer, more exciting trips. And at one point I did a trip that a friend of mine and I called the A to the K trip.
Yeah.
It was Algonquin to Killarney.
Okay.
So we followed sort of like a horseshoe shape through Algonquin Park in Ontario. And then took the South River up to Lake Nipissing. And then went down the French River and through a bit of Georgian Bay to get to Killarney Park.
Yeah.
And that was a little over 500 kilometers.
Cool.
And I think that's when I realized, like, oh, 500 kilometers, like, that's a big chunk of distance. But if I were going across country, it would just be, like, you know, a multiple of those trips.
Yeah.
So I could do something like that. And then I ended up in the Lakehead University Outdoor Recreation Program.
Right.
And while I was there, I took this course called Expedition Management.
Sounds like a sweet course.
Super awesome. Yeah, like one of my favorite courses that I took there. But yeah, one of our major assignment was to plan a major expedition of some kind.
Right.
And I thought,
a lot of it's just logistics, I think, eh?
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, carry on.
Well, why don't I do this? But of course, like, you know, other people were planning like some 2 week expedition or something, whereas this is like a really long and drawn out thing that I needed to gather a lot of info for.
So for the course you planned the cross country.
Yeah. Okay. Basically I thought, you know, why don't I plan this cross country trip?
Then once you've planned it, you can't not do it.
Yeah. And I guess, you know, shortly before that, I'd read a couple books that inspired me. Max Finkelstein's Canoeing a Continent on the Trail of Alexander Mackenzie.
Okay.
And also Gary and Joni McGuffin's book. They're pretty well-known photographers, and the name of the title escapes me right now.
Right.
But, yeah, between those two books, they covered the route that I was doing.
And what was the route?
So I left from just outside of Montreal, a place called St. Anne.
Yeah.
And it's right where the Ottawa and the St. Lawrence meet.
Right.
So I started at the bottom of the Ottawa River,
mm-hmm.
and went up the Ottawa, then made my way over to the Mattawa River,
mm-hmm.
that flows downstream toward Lake Nipissing, and then took a series of portages to get to Lake Nipissing, then French River to Lake Huron, Georgian Bay, followed Georgian Bay in the North Channel,
mm-hmm.
over Lake Superior. Then I took the Grand Portage, or Grand Portage, they call it in Minnesota.
Yeah.
So I crossed the Ontario border. That's a funny story in itself, actually. But yeah, then followed the U.S.-Canada border. Back and forth every day until I got to Lake of the Woods.
How's that work? Like, are you camping in the U.S. some nights and camping in Canada others?
I was trying to just camp on the Canadian side.
Right.
I figured that was the best way of going about it, because I think, technically speaking, you're supposed to tell them, oh, I'm camping on the Canadian side, or I'm camping on the American
right.
side. Mind you, when you find yourself out in the middle of nowhere, or, you know, there are lots of recreational paddlers there and they have established campsites, especially on the U.S. side.
Yeah.
But there's no one around, you know.
To tell.
It's right. almost sunset.
Right.
And you're just looking for a place to camp, and there's this perfect place on the American side. Well, yeah, sure.
Right.
Camped on the American side, too.
It's like, so I was talking to someone recently who I won't name, who paddled the Rio Grande, and I was like, so did you camp in Mexico? Or they never were cleared to go into Mexico. They were just like, they were in the States lawfully. I was like, did you camp on Mexico? And they just like winked back. They're like, no, we didn't camp in Mexico. Cool. That's cool. Anyway, so carry on.
From there, Lake of the Woods, Winnipeg River to Lake Winnipeg.
Yeah.
Then up the Saskatchewan River, which is, it's still pretty fast flowing.
Yeah, that's like 1,000 kilometers.
Hey, quick question for you. Are you someone who wants to be fit, healthy, and happy? And what if I told you could get your dream body by simply just listening to a podcast? I'm Josh.
And I'm KG, and we are the hosts of the Fit, Healthy, and Happy podcast.
Listen, we get it. Fitness isn't easy. Carbs, no carbs.
Just stop, okay? It doesn't have to be that complicated. And that's why we made this podcast. We get straight to the facts so you can become your best you.
So the way to check us out is click the link in the show notes or search Fit, Healthy, and Happy podcast on any of the major podcast platforms. We'll see you soon.
This is up. Stream, isn't it? Like, how the Saskatchewan River is a long river.
A whole lot.
How long did that take?
That, you know, I believe it or not, I wasn't on the Saskatchewan for too long, because then I switched over to the Sturgeon Weir River,
okay,
which is one of the tributaries of the Saskatchewan that brings you up to the Churchill River,
right?
And then I went up the Churchill River to a place called La Loche, Saskatchewan,
yeah.
which has kind of been in the news for not so positive things.
Yeah, that's where there were some suicides, right?
Yeah, and I think there was a shooting there in recent years.
Yeah.
And it kind of makes sense because I remember going up the Churchill. I met people in communities along the way, and they said, whatever you do, don't stop in La Lush. People will rob you and leave you naked on an island. I was hearing these kind of things, and I was thinking it was a little bit overblown. But yeah, I made a point of not really stopping in La Lush.
Right.
From there, it was a 20-ish kilometer portage to get to the Clearwater River.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was the final height of land where, I was finally going downstream for the rest of the way. I'd had little downstream stints before that. Like the French River was downstream. Yeah. The Rainy River and the Winnipeg River were downstream, but the rest of it had all been upstream. Clearwater to the Athabasca River, to Lake Athabasca, then Slave River to Great Slave Lake, and then the Mackenzie, Decho, all the way to Inuvik.
Man. Yeah.
And I'd actually wanted to go to Tuktoyaktuk.
Yeah.
But when I got to Inuvik, I had a friend come in to pick me up from Whitehorse. And there was time for me to still get to Tuk and fly back.
Right.
But there was a bit of an uncomfortable situation where this family had gone out to their whaling camp somewhere in the Mackenzie Delta on an island, and was in some bad weather, and all these people were missing, and they basically had like search and rescue out looking for them.
Right.
And I just felt like it was sort of, it just felt awkward.
Yeah.
Like going out on this.
Yeah, right. And if you ran into trouble, you'd be like then taking away resources from their search or.
Yeah. Or maybe not necessarily that. Like I didn't really expect myself getting into trouble. I just felt like maybe that last hurrah was like a little bit disrespectful.
Right.
To like all the people that were
right.
looking for their loved ones out there. You know?
No, that's true.
Yeah.
So you called it Nanuvik.
So I called it an Inuvik, yeah.
Probably but, enough paddling by then anyway.
Yeah.
And you were you did the solo, eh?
Mm-hmm.
Man, that is a...
That was... I didn't know what I was getting into, to be honest with you. I'm glad I was so naive, because if I knew how I was going to feel about it once I got into it,
yeah,
I would have never gone.
This is...
I was just like, hey... I can go. I can just do this by myself.
Right.
I had plans to do it with another buddy, but he ended up starting a new business and couldn't really leave his business behind.
Right.
We'd always planned to do it together. He was like, oh, well, maybe you can find someone else. And there was a guy who I worked with at a camp who was super interested. And we got like months into planning it. And then he went, I don't think I can make this work.
Right.
And then I found myself at some party and people had a lot to drink and met some random person out of nowhere and, mentioned to her that I was thinking of doing this thing or I was planning to do this thing. I just needed a paddling partner. Oh, I'll come with you. And... And I realized that, if I really want to be sure I'm going to do this.
You got to do it alone.
I just got to do it alone.
And yeah.
So that's what I planned to do. And the day I was leaving, I went like, holy shit, like, this is kind of a big deal.
Yeah, no doubt.
And really struggled a lot with loneliness, like, over the whole...
I believe it, man. I get lonely going solo for like a weekend, weekend canoeing, I like doing my canoe trips with a crew.
Yeah.
That's a long, like how long did this take?
11 months.
Yeah. Three summers.
Yeah, three springs and summers.
Yeah.
I'd originally planned on doing it in two, but when I got out there, there were opportunities to like do really cool things and meet people and like go to their barbecue or, you know,
right,
attend you some event. And I was like, no, sorry, I gotta keep going. So somewhere along the line in the first year, I decided to extend it to 3 years.
Yeah.
Which again, if I'd known that I was going to do it in 3 years, I probably wouldn't have done it.
Right.
But at that point I was,
I was too far into it
and committed. So I felt like I had to stick with it.
Right.
I wanted to stick with it. But yeah, I split it into three sections. So I paddled, just outside of Montreal to Kenora, Ontario.
Yeah.
The first year. So really close to the Manitoba border. And then next year picked up from there and on to Fort McMurray, Alberta.
Yeah.
And then Fort McMurray to Inuvik.
Yeah.
Last year. And that was like, you know, the last hurrah.
And all downhill.
Yeah.
So amazing. You and I share having paddled the Mackenzie River in common.
Yeah.
And
did you do it in high water too?
Yeah.
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 Okay.
High water. I kind of share your take on that river. It's like, I'm happy I did it, but I wouldn't do it again. You mm-hmm. know, it's just so hard to find good camping. Mm-hmm. I think there's a lot of good camping, but in our year it was all underwater. So all these like gravel bars and things that people had told us were there were not there. And there's just like no fishing because the silty water, like you're not going to catch any fish, which like I love canoeing, but I love canoeing in large part because I love the fishing that it like allows you to access.
Yeah. And your family sort of has a bit of a fishing background.
Not really. Like my brother, no. My brother's pretty into fishing.
Yeah.
Not really. We were like always, you know, we recreational fishing, never fishermen, but never too serious about it.
Yeah.
My fishing has peaked since I've been living in Yellowknife. You know, it's like, it's just so easy here. There's like, you know, out east, it's, you know, you're lucky if you catch like a 12-inch bass or something, but here it's amazing.
Yeah, I think it sort of depends. Like if you go from town, like a place that you can reach in a day.
Yes.
You know, it's not as spectacular as if you're way out in the East Arm or something.
It's amazing.
Like
the minute you get, get on, that's what I mean. This is why I love canoe trips. You can access the most amazing fishing.
Yeah.
So the Mackenzie doesn't have that. It's just like, it's just a tough river, man. It's so big. Like when we paddled it, we didn't appreciate, like we knew it was big, but we didn't appreciate how big it was. And then you get onto it and you're just like, oh my God, I can't wait to get around that next bend and see something new. The problem is the next bend is like 35 kilometers away, like 3 hours of paddling, you know, it's just unfold. It's like a time warp. It unfolds so slowly.
Mm-hmm.
And it's enormous. Yeah, the camping's not great. I don't know. It was, we had fun, but I wouldn't paddle it again.
So this was the East Arm?
No, the Mackenzie.
Oh, well, the Mackenzie. Oh, sorry.
Yeah, I love the East Arm. I'll go back to the East Arm anytime.
Yeah, the Mackenzie, I remember, I was looking for those gravel bars too.
Yeah.
And could rarely find them.
Yeah.
And so that inspired me to just put in longer days. Oh, well, just keep going.
We got,
by the time I was there, you know, it was, there was twilight for like all the night. And so it didn't really matter what time I quit for the day.
Yeah, we got into this mentality where like, it doesn't make sense to do anything on the shore. Like, we can just cook in the canoe.
Yeah.
I was like cooking meals in the canoe because the current's ripping along at like 6 or 7 kilometers an hour on average. So you're like, an hour on the shore is like not going to get me anywhere. An hour of like just sitting in the boat, even if I'm not paddling, will get me 6 kilometers downstream. So I was like stir frying. Like, I got really good at it. I had like a whole setup. Like, in front of me, I had like the Bear Barrel kind of vertical that had like a flat top on it with like the stove and cooking, and we did everything in the canoe. We were the same. We were just like these long days in the canoe, and we were also a bit tight on time. We probably bit off a bit more than we could chew, So we were like, we had these, and we got winded out several days where you just couldn't be on the river. So then we had to do like these long days to get to Inuvik on time. So we were just like in the canoe for like 16, 17 hours, you know, mm-hmm. but even if you weren't paddling, just floating down the river.
Did you have a spray deck on your boat or no, did you have a spray deck with you?
No. Yeah. Let's talk about spray decks. I saw that you wrote an article in Canadian Geographic about them. You're a big proponent.
Yeah. I mean, if there's a reason that it makes sense to bring a spray deck, I always will.
Yeah.
I've definitely found, well, my first experience with spray decks was paddling across country and, yeah, I just found that it helped me in so many circumstances, not only with waves coming over the boat, but just keeping the wind out.
Yeah.
Because if you think about it, if you got an open canoe, there are sort of two surfaces that can act as a sail and right, catch the wind.
The exterior hull, but also the interior hull.
Yeah.
Right, and by putting the spray deck on, you eliminate the interior hull.
Yep.
Yeah. In that article you wrote for Canadian Geographic, you talk about being on the East Arm with a shoreline that's a vertical cliff and getting into some trouble. Like, what happened there?
Oh, no, I think that was just kind of supposing what could possibly happen.
Sure, yeah.
And, like, being prepared for that.
Yeah.
But yeah, I have paddled along some, you know, vertical cliff areas in the East Arm, and yeah, having that spray deck, especially if you're doing long open water crossings,
yeah,
it gives you that extra insurance, knowing that, I mean, obviously you want to make the wisest decision you can based on the weather, but if something unexpected happens with the weather, then you know that you're not going to have waves pouring into your boat and that you're gonna get blown around to the point that you can't really go anywhere.
And it's, you can see how easy it could happen, you know, like the freeboard on a canoe is like what, like 8 inches on a fully loaded boat, and the minute you get into some waves, it can, yeah, if you don't have a spray deck on, you can get swamped so fast. I've been in a few situations where you're like, we've just been close to shore, but you're like, oh man, if we were trying to make a crossing here, we would be fucked. You know, it's like, yeah, you know, of all the things you can do paddling, like people talk about whitewater and how it's dangerous and stuff, which is true, but it's lake paddling. It's like, if you're going to get into trouble, it's on the lakes, you know, cause it can be like, you can think you're fine, and then you're crossing a bay of some sort and a wind comes up and you're suddenly not fine and you're in a lot of trouble. You know, and like, especially up here in the north where the water is, you know, even in the height of summer, it's like 5 degrees or something. Like, you can't swim more than like a couple hundred meters before your muscles all seize up.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, yeah.
Especially if you're on some of those bigger lakes, like if you're out in the East Arm on Christie Bay, that's like the deepest point of Great Slave Lake.
Yeah.
That makes it the deepest lake in North America. And yeah, the water there is just frigid,
even in the height of summer. Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
Of course.
I remember actually being on McLeod Bay.
Yeah.
Which doesn't get quite as deep, but it's a little bit further north, a few summers ago. And it was a little bit chilly, but the sun was out and everything, and it felt warm. I wasn't like bundled up or anything. And I remember leaning over, I was like rinsing out a pot or something in the water, and exhaled. And I could see my breath along the surface of the water, I guess, because there was this like cold air that was lingering.
Yeah.
It was really calm that day.
Right.
Yeah.
So yeah. It's like, I've been paddling on Great Slave in July where you're in like, you know, a t-shirt and shorts because it's hot and you have bare feet on the bottom of the boat.
Yeah.
And your feet are freezing cold. It's like, makes her reminds you that this water ain't warm, you know.
Yeah,
you won't want to fall in.
But it's good for carrying perishable foods.
That's true. And fish, we would catch fish and just throw them down in the bottom of the boat, like out of the sun.
In the fridge.
Totally.
Yeah.
Totally. I mean, I'm sure you had so many highlights on this cross Canada trip, but like, what sticks out?
If I think about it chronologically, going up the Ottawa River was a bit of a slog.
Yeah.
And I was carrying all sorts of gear that I didn't necessarily keep with me the entire time. I was like testing some things out on the go. And I was like, okay, well, if I don't need this, I can ditch it. So it was a bit more heavily loaded, but just a bit of a tough time with the wind and battling the current. And
Ottawa River's like kind of raging too, isn't it? Like people, there's a lot of people whitewater kayak and stuff on that river.
Definitely in a lot of places.
Yeah, but, like, and you were going upstream.
Yeah.
Wow.
And you know, I eventually figured out the right kind of paddle arrangement.
Mm-hmm.
When I was listening to the podcast with, I forget his name, the guy who is part of organizing the Yukon River Quest.
Oh, Stephen Mooney.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A lot of what he was saying kind of resonated with me. There was this guy who I met in Ottawa, Max Finkelstein, who wrote one of those books that inspired me.
Yeah.
I ended up staying at his house for a couple of days and celebrating my birthday there.
Cool.
Which was really nice.
Yeah.
But he comes from more of a racing background.
Right.
And so he was like, you know, the boat you have is like, that's top notch for like doing distance. But, you know, I had the 56-inch bent shaft paddle,
mm-hmm.
which if you're paddling more of a racing style, that's way too long.
Mm-hmm.
I ended up finishing off my trip with, I think it was a 48-inch bent shaft.
And why is the shorter shaft better?
So you're just not lifting the paddle out of the water so high.
I see, yeah.
And you're not lifting your grip hand over your head or over your eye level.
Mm-hmm.
And you're taking a lot shorter strokes, shorter, like more powerful strokes, and really focusing on using your torso.
Right.
So I came from the Ontario canoeing background where, you know, we all had otter tail, like the really slender, long paddles.
Yeah, that's what I've always done my trips with, and I always come home from my trips with like a bung shoulder.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not doing it right. I know I'm not doing it right.
So anyway, Max was the first one who introduced me to using like one of these shorter bent shaft paddles.
Yeah.
Made of carbon fiber.
Right.
And yeah, man, I could really like race with that thing. So
cool.
There was a paddle maker who I met along my journey, Andy Convery from Echo Paddles.
Okay.
And he built me another paddle for the trip that was like 58 inches or something. It was way too long.
Right.
And anyway, thanks so much for doing that, Andy. But he offered to make me another paddle. And so he built me the 48-inch bent shaft that was a combination of carbon fiber and wood.
Oh, nice.
So
carbon fiber blade, wood handle or something?
Wood sandwich between carbon fiber on either side,
right,
for the blade.
Yeah.
And then carbon fiber shaft and wood handle.
Cool.
Yeah. But like super light paddle too.
Yeah.
So yeah, just like what Steven was mentioning about, like, you know, the weight of lifting your paddle on every stroke.
Yeah.
Like, this thing was so light, I could just do so much more distance.
Yeah, I think that's been my problem. I, like, have this, like, beautiful, as you were talking about, like, narrow blade maple paddle. which is like obviously very heavy. Like it's a beautiful paddle and I've done a lot of trips with it, but I always come back with like my left shoulder is like always like bungled somehow. It's like it's like this one motion, you know, but you like have to do the motion like tens of thousands of times a day.
Back to highlights.
Yeah.
So yeah, Ottawa River was like such a slog, but then all of a sudden there was a tailwind.
Yeah.
And I had a sail with me. I use a different kind of sail now, but this was like an Ostrom Outdoors sail. They sponsored me for the trip. They make packs and other canoeing equipment.
Yeah.
But sort of like shut down their business and have now like reopened in a certain limited capacity.
Yeah.
But Bill Ostrom gave me a sail that you slide paddles into pockets on either side.
Okay.
And I found ways to sort of wedge it into the canoe, like
yeah,
under the seat underneath me, and that would hold the sail up.
Amazing.
I spent a bunch of time sailing upriver.
Really? Upriver?
Yeah, doing like huge distance.
On the Ottawa?
Sailing upriver on the Ottawa.
That must feel good.
And it helped because I had a rudder on my boat.
I was going to ask you, I think I heard you say you had a rudder on your boat. What was that setup? What did that setup look like?
So it wasn't anything I'd really ever considered before. And I knew I was going to do this trip, but I didn't know what kind of boat I was going to take. And I went to a few trade shows and film festivals where they had a bit of a trade show outside.
Yeah.
And met this guy named Keith Robertson, who owns Souris River Canoes out of Ontario, Atticoken, Ontario.
Yeah.
And he had something on display, and it was basically a version of my boat.
What boat were you in?
It's a boat that they call the Tranquility Solo.
Okay.
So it's 15 feet, 8 inches long, and only about 28 inches across.
Right.
So like very
narrow.
Very narrow. Very fast. Yeah. Doesn't turn very easily.
No.
More of like a racing style of boat, which I wasn't accustomed to up until that point. Like more of like a shallow arched sort of hull.
Yeah.
So like very tippy when you first get into it, but like very stable when you're in, you know, all the hairy stuff.
Right.
On big lakes and whatnot. It dives into waves a bit more than I would have liked, but like the spray deck took care of that. And I was out on like 2 foot waves, 2 meter waves out on Lake Superior.
Oh my God.
With like kayaker friends of mine who were like trying to push me to see what I could do out there.
Oh my God. And terrifying.
Was totally fine with it. But anyway, I met Keith at one of those shows and, you know, sort of asked about the boat, and he was like, you want to paddle across Canada? Like, you should take this boat. Like, we'll sponsor you. And he had a rudder attached to it.
Cool.
And I was like, well, what's the deal with the rudder? And he's like, well, you know, it's good because you got foot pedals, and the way we've set it up, there are foot pedals that are independent of the steering, like the steering you do with the toes.
Right.
So that gives you good like bracing in the boat.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Again, like sort of in line with the racing style.
Mm-hmm.
And then, yeah, you know, I mean, the boat's really fast, but it doesn't turn very easily. So we figured like putting a rudder on there would be a good idea just to help people out a little bit. But it has a tremendous advantage for sailing.
Sailing, for sure.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah, which is incredible. And since then I've tried putting rudders on a few other boats.
Yeah.
And then a lot of the time I find I don't necessarily use it because having my feet forward all the time, just, you know, it can give me back and glute issues. Like I get sore eventually.
Right.
I could never be a kayaker because when I'm stuck in a kayak for any extended period of time, my back cramps up and everything.
Yeah.
I've been on a whole lot of trips where, you know, the wind's going in the right general direction.
Yeah.
And the rudder just helps like turn you that little bit extra in the direction you want to go. And then like both, you know, if you get your sail set up, both paddlers can just be chilling in the boat, hands free, going to life, wherever you're going.
You're like ripping downwind with a sail and a canoe. Oh, it's such a good feeling.
Ripping like, you know, twice the speed you'd be paddling, going like, okay, is it getting too fast? No, I think we're still okay. All right, I'm going to make you a sandwich.
You paddled up on Clinton Colton, eh?
Yeah.
Yeah, I was up there this summer, and we had a ripping tailwind, and we sailed, must have sailed like 40K. It's awesome.
Oh, that's awesome.
It was awesome.
Yeah. I did the Ida Trail, which is from, I guess, up around Great Bear Lake down to Great Slave.
Yeah, you've done that, eh?
Or the opposite way.
Yeah, which way did you go?
We started up in the north and we came down south. So we flew into a place called Conjurer Bay and did a little tour, paddled around Richardson Island, I think it's called, and just kind of explored up there. I really wanted to see Great Bear. And it was early July and there was still ice.
Still tons of ice probably.
Yeah. And at one point we thought we were going to be trapped by the ice and we found a way out. And then we were beyond, you know, where it looked like the ice would have trapped us. But, incredible spot. I remember we went, oh, well, we haven't done any fishing. Maybe we should fish. And I remember...
Hell yeah, you should fish on Great Bear.
getting my fishing rod out. And I tend to bring those, like, telescoping rods. And so, you know, I'm extending that and... the spoon like drops in the water next to the boat and I noticed like a whole bunch of fish swimming right under it and the hook was kind of stuck to the spoon so it probably wouldn't have hooked them anyway. I just like pulled the spoon out, adjusted the hook, dropped it back in and like jigged the line a couple times and we had dinner.
You had a trout on. Yeah, it's amazing.
But yeah, we went north to south, and there was a long stretch through there where we were going straight south.
Yeah, and a big north wind.
And big north wind for like a couple of days. Amazing. And just like banging off the kilometers, chilling in the boat, relaxing.
So good.
Yeah,
I've always been kind of curious about that route. It just looks neat.
Yeah. So that was a big highlight for me. I think like lake paddling, Lake Superior, Lake Winnipeg.
Mm-hmm.
What are the other big lakes that I did? Some other big ones along the way. Great Slave. I wasn't on the Athabasca for very long. But I really fell in love with lake paddling.
Right.
And I like big lake paddling on that trip.
It's a good thing because there's a lot of it.
And I think part of it was being outfitted the best way to be doing that, like having the right kind of boat.
Yeah.
Having the spray deck and having the rudder. Like if you got those things, then you're good to go. And partway through, I sort of switched it up. I started with only single blade paddles, like canoe paddles. But by the end I had that really short bent shaft canoe paddle and a Werner, bent shaft, like carbon fiber kayak paddle.
Right.
So I found that, if I was paddling on rough water or moving water, I would tend to switch over to the double blade.
Yeah.
And if it was calm out, really enjoyed the single blade.
Did you do any like kayak when you say double blade kayak style?
Yeah. And it's great for especially if you're in really big waves, like just being able to brace on either side at any given time.
Right.
Similar thing in rapids too.
Right.
Yeah.
What? You said it took 11 months, the whole thing?
Mm-hmm.
So you were doing what, like 3.5 months each summer?
Yeah, about that.
Setting off in May, like May sometime?
Mm-hmm. I think the first year, when did I leave? It was actually early in April. And it was quite cold out. Before then, I hadn't been someone who paddled with rubber boots.
Yeah.
But someone told me, like, no, you gotta have rubber boots. And I was like, okay, well, I guess that was one of the things that I brought in. I was like, I don't know, maybe I'll ditch this somewhere.
Yeah.
But holy smokes, like, especially paddling solo.
Yeah.
It's really hard to get out of the canoe
right,
paddling
right.
solo, like little solo canoes. Like you can't walk, you can't beach the, especially a narrow one like I had, you can't easily beach the bow on the water and walk.
No, you could be in
through the canoe to the bow. No, like no. You basically tip yourself by the time
you're
get
in,
there.
You're in the back of the canoes in deep water. Yeah, of course.
Yeah. So, rubber boots really made a difference. Started in April, and along the way there was this person who got in touch with me from a water conservation group in Ontario.
Mm-hmm.
Down around the Barrie area.
Cool.
Who said, can we have you speak at our watershed conference? And I said, well, okay, sure. And we'll pay for you to come down and everything. So basically I put the trip on hold, and that's around the time that I decided to extend it. So those two decisions sort of
right.
came together.
Yeah.
So I took a little bit of a vacation from the trip over the first summer, and then I ended in Kenora, I think it was very early September.
Okay.
Then started in Kenora sometime in May the next year.
Yeah.
And got to Fort McMurray by, I think again, like the first days of September, somewhere around there. And then next year left Fort McMurray at the very end of May. And then got to Inuvik in early August, I think it was.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Long.
But I really took my time on that last stretch. I was like, eh.
Yeah, you could do that quicker for sure. Just thinking, you know, it's a pretty quick run down the Mackenzie, and then the Peace is moving pretty quick, and or the Slave rather. You weren't in the Peace. The Slave River is moving pretty quick. And
but I think I developed a bit of a weird style, which was during that year, which was just going really hard. Trying to like push myself, maybe do a distance that I'd never done before.
Yeah.
And then just like rest after that.
Just chill.
And like take a day off.
What was the long, on that whole trip, what was the longest day? And distance, not time.
So longest distance on, that I could say was on like mostly flat water.
Yeah.
Was I did a 75 kilometer
holy smokes
day on the south shore of Great Slave Lake.
Yeah.
When the water was calm, because I had so many days when the water was rough and like I couldn't go anywhere.
Yeah.
Finally it was calm. I was going to go as far as I could. And then after that I was wondering, oh well, I probably can't beat that. And then I paddled the last stretch of Great Slave Lake and got into the start of the Mackenzie.
Yeah.
And once you get into the start of the Mackenzie, I mean, maybe there are places to camp that that I didn't find. but I just couldn't find anything.
The Mackenzie, like, man.
It was all marsh, like, yeah, right at, yeah, at the beginning there.
This was our experience.
Oh, so you started that far upstream too?
No, we didn't start there, but just generally, okay, on the...
Yeah.
You can go miles and
finding
there's nowhere
hard
to camp.
To find a place to camp. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, everything was soggy. And there's like a thunder and lightning storm that rolled through. And I just like toughed it through it. And then I got to... So that part, I feel like it's got a name... Mills Lake,
Mills Lake
is further down.
I know what you're talking about. It's, yeah, on the north side of the river, just past Fort Simpson.
Okay, so yeah, that's a different spot, but it's almost a lake. Like the river's very wide, the
right,
current isn't very strong. So I made it to just outside of Fort Providence,
or Fort Providence rather. That's what I'm talking about.
Day,
yeah,
from, yeah, somewhere. Somewhere on the big lake. So, yeah, that was 85 kilometers. And then when
day.
I was on the Mackenzie, I took a whole lot of time off. I chilled in Fort Simpson for a bunch of days.
Yeah.
Oh, I had a package waiting for me there because I sent food supplies to various different post offices, general delivery. And I got to Fort Simpson at the beginning of a long weekend. So it was like... just after the post office closed on a Friday,
right,
and I had to wait till the Tuesday to pick up my package. But then, yeah, I just started having fun, like trying to challenge myself.
Yeah.
And between Wrigley and Toledo, that's where I noticed the strongest,
yeah,
current.
Yeah.
So, yeah, in over the course of 20 hours, I did 135 kilometers.
Holy smokes.
But the current was going at like 15 kilometers,
yeah,
or something.
Yeah.
And, you know, is 20 hours like really one day of paddling?
Right.
It's,
yeah,
hard to say.
It's true. It's when you're in current, it's a different thing. It's like we were talking about Stephen Mooney and the River Quest. It's like, I forget how many hours he told me people do. 700 kilometer race.
40.
Yeah, just under. Yeah, like, yeah. I think like 50. If you break the 50 hour barrier, you're like in the elite class. It's just insane. Like, these guys, yeah, are covering so much ground so fast. You know, so it's different. But 75 kilometers on flat water is a huge day. That's a huge day.
Yeah, so I feel like those kind of experiences give me an idea of what it would be like to do the Yukon River Quest.
Yeah.
Which is something I've always aspired to.
I want to do it, man. Let's assemble a team, Yellowknife team.
Yeah.
Let's go.
Yeah.
That's been on my to-do list for a long time. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, Steven's like, you should come. So, hey, maybe not this year, but one of these years.
Yeah.
Let's do it.
I had this idea for training for the Yukon River Quest.
Yeah.
And, you know, probably most people won't be able to find the time to do this. But my thought was, well before it starts.
Yeah.
Start in Dawson.
Okay.
Paddle upstream.
To Whitehorse?
All the way to Whitehorse. Time that out, like whatever time it's going to take, which would be a significant.
Yes.
Probably a number of weeks, right?
Yeah, 700 kilometers up going upstream. What, can you do 25 a day? Maybe.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe less.
Maybe less.
Yeah, where the currents are pretty swift.
Yeah, several weeks for sure.
Yeah.
Several weeks. You'd be hard-pressed to have enough time, I think.
Yeah.
Because when the break, you know, the ice isn't off the river till May sometime, and the race is in early July.
That might be the tricky part there.
Yeah, but anyway, carry on. I'm curious to hear what you're envisioning. Yeah.
Anyway, my fantasy was... you paddle upstream, and that way, something I've learned is that I think I really get to know a river a lot more intimately by paddling it upstream.
Yes.
You know, when you're going downstream, oh, well, take this side, take that side, you know, the speed of the current doesn't make
much
of a difference.
You're flying by the shore so fast.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Whereas going upstream, you know, you pay a lot more attention to that, like taking river left versus taking river right might mean that you know, you can't keep going any further.
So
just learn a lot about the river that way, but also get into super great shape.
And then have a huge advantage when you go down, being one, fit, and two, with the river knowledge. It's a good idea.
There you go.
It is a good idea. I love the commitment. Mm-hmm. Stephen told me that that race used to start in, what's the name of the little community in Alaska? Skagway.
Oh.
It used to start in Skagway, and it started with a race, like a hike over the Chilkoot Pass.
Wow.
And then you would put in, I forget the name of the lake there, where the gold miners would like then start the downriver trip to Whitehorse,
mm-hmm.
and then go from Whitehorse all the way to Dawson. So it used to be like this like multi-sport, much longer race, but the national park there and the border made it a bit tricky. Mm-hmm. But it used to be much longer than the 700 kilometers it is today. And then it changed like 20 years ago or something into what it is. He was an interesting guy, man. He's won it like several times. He's like a paddling machine.
Cool.
Yeah. And I think he knows that river really well. Like the sense I got talking to him was he knows exactly where you need to be to like maximize the current, which is probably what it's all about. It's all about just being in the current, you know.
Yeah,
like, you know what it's like on these big rivers, like if you're in the current, you're moving, but the minute you like you get into the wrong channel or something, you know, you can get into these like dead ends almost, you know. So
like parts of the Mackenzie, and maybe it's all like this, but I remember getting past Fort Good Hope and I just couldn't seem to find like a pocket of really fast current anymore.
Yeah.
And maybe that's just the nature of the river. It widens out there, right? But I kept thinking like, oh, there's got to be a better place to be. And there probably was.
Yeah, I remember thinking the same thing. The other thing that was crazy about that river is you'd be paddling along the shore and you'd come around like a little headland or a point or something. And then suddenly you'd be in an eddy that's like 10 football fields. This, it's like huge, and you're like in it, you're like looking at the shore and you're going back up river and you're in this eddy that's like literally like 500 meters by 400 meters wide, and you're just, it's just like astounding the volume of water going down that river.
So do you paddle the Sansu and the Ramparts too?
That's you know, I talk negatively about that trip, but That part of the river is beautiful.
Yeah.
Like the Norman Wells to Fort Good Hope stretch is just gorgeous. The Sansu Rapids and the Ramparts. And we camped right there at the mount where the mountain river flows into, right at the Sansu Rapids. Right, like that campsite is amazing. There's some beautiful parts of that river. And we did a lot of that paddling at night. There's like weird. Remember one night right past the Sansu Rapids, we were paddling at night and there was just like weird optical illusions happening. Like I was convinced I was looking at like big white water downstream, but like way downstream, like just almost as far as I could see.
Huh.
I was like, there are standing waves that are 6 feet high down there. Rupe and I were like, well, we better like get out of the middle of the river and over to shore here, 'cause we might have to like, you know, you don't want to like end up in that. And we like ended up then camping short of where I thought they were, because we had been paddling basically all night. I think it was like 4 a.m. We like pulled off to camp, and we were like, the next morning, we need to get ready for what could be like big time whitewater, which was odd because I didn't think there was big whitewater in that stretch of river. And the next morning we get there and there's nothing. It's like as flat as a pancake. But the night before I was like convinced there was like this huge like stacks of white water ahead of us, you know. It's just like such a huge river, all these plays all these like tricks on you, you know. You've done a bunch like I know that I've been picking your brain about this cross Canada trip, but you've been on a bunch of trips up here too, eh?
So I did a trip in 2012 with a group of six guys total, including me. And we left from Yellowknife and went out the east arm over Pike's Portage.
Yeah, yeah.
Up the Lockhart.
Yeah, which
did you do that?
I did
too?
That. Yeah, I did that this summer.
Cool. And then we made our way to the copper mine.
From there, you made your way to the copper mine from there.
Yeah. So McKay Lake, there's a little river that flows in called the Snake. Mm-hmm. I think there are a bunch of snake rivers in different places, but
yeah.
So we went up the Snake, and then that brings you to Courageous Lake
area.
That's
a beautiful lake, I've heard.
Yeah. And from there it was, like lake hopping up to get to the copper mine. And then down the copper mine all the way to Kugluktuk. And I guess that was just below DeStefani Lake, where we came into the copper mine.
Yeah.
So not too far from
Lac de Gras or whatever.
Lac de Gras, yeah.
Cool. That's a cool trip. That's what, how long did that take?
That was 50 days.
Yeah.
We budgeted 50 days for that, and we knew it was going to be like pretty ambitious. And
yeah.
We came in right on the 50th
really?
Day.
Really? Yeah.
Like, on the nose.
Were you carrying a whole 50 days worth of food?
No, actually, we, Dave and Kristen Olson helped
us
out a little bit.
Yeah, yeah.
So they're, yeah, Bush. He's a Bush pilot, and they live way out in the East Arm. I think you've talked about them on another podcast.
Oliver Duray, who's been on the show, knows them well.
But yeah, Dave flew in some stuff for us right at the Narrows at Clinton Colden Lake,
where it goes into Almer.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a neat spot. Eh? We paddled through there this summer. There's like that big, we had, I'm trying to explain it for the listeners because no one else who listens to this show has probably been there. You like paddle through this Narrows, and right in the middle of the Narrows, it like splits into two channels, and there's that like big, I shouldn't say mountain, it's like this hill, but it's like very prominent. And we had lunch on the top, and then we found out after we had lunch there that, forget what explorer also wrote in his diary about having lunch. Oh, fuck. Who was the name of the guy? We then paddled from there to Almer, and we ran it. We overnighted at Almer Lake Lodge. Okay. We, like, detoured in there. We always meant to go, but we didn't think it would necessarily be open, but it was. The owners were there, and they hosted us for the night, and they treated us really well. He was the one who told us that prominent mound was, like, kind of famous, and I forget. I forget the guy's name who like wrote about eating lunch on the summit where we like the day before had also eaten lunch.
Cool.
So yeah, cool.
I started a trip, just speaking of like interesting spots like that. I started a trip where we made our way to the Emil River and down the Emil River.
Yeah.
In the Klitschko region. And we started on, oh, I think it's called Mesa Lake. And there's a spot there where Edzo and Akecho made peace between the, I guess, the Klitschko and the Dene Sutline.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hope I'm getting all that right. But yeah, there's like an interesting little like flat space there, and we think we found it.
Yeah, what's cool about all the, like, when you go on these trips, you know, is a good campsite today was a good campsite like 600 years ago.
Yeah,
you know, so people keep camping in the same places over and over and over again.
Yeah,
and that's what amazes me. Like, these roots are old, like, you know, there's signs of life all over the place on these roots. Like, a number of the places we were camping this summer were the stones, we found the stone circles, you know, where evidence of people setting up tents like hundreds of years ago, putting stones around to hold them down, you know, hold the edges of the tent down. It's just so cool, you know. It's like people have been, I'm sure you saw it on your cross Canada trip, because that was the old fir route, wasn't it? Like,
for, you know, sure.
Like, I read Mackenzie, like, obviously the Mackenzie River is named after him, but he started in Montreal.
Yeah.
Like, he got up to Inuvik, what is now Inuvik, from Montreal. You basically followed his route, I would probably pretty close, eh?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think pretty much to a T.
Yeah, pretty much to a T.
Yeah, that guy who I mentioned, Max Finkelstein, he sort of did the same thing, but I think Mackenzie tried a second time to get to the Pacific.
Yeah.
So he followed that route, and I followed
his Mackenzie.
His original route, where he was trying to find the Pacific Ocean, but ended up at the Arctic Ocean.
Yeah. And then he was disappointed about it. It was like the whole trip was a failure for him.
Yeah. The River of Disappointment.
The River of Disappointment. There's a great book called Disappointment River, which I was reading while we were paddling the Mackenzie by, I forget the guy who wrote it. He's an American guy. But he did a fantastic job with the book. And he talks about being on the Mackenzie like you, and like he paddled the Mackenzie, and it was one of those books where like one chapter would be about his trip and then the next chapter would be like a historical context, and he'd like write about the history and he'd keep bouncing back and forth. And he talks in that book about being stuck on the river with like a thunderstorm coming, you know, through, and like there being nowhere to camp. So feeling you were describing, he like writes about beautifully in the book, which then kind of happened to us. And we were like, that's why I was like reading the book and being like, yeah, this guy is nailing it. Like, this is exactly what it's like to paddle the river. But then they camped in Fort Providence and they woke up and all their shit was stolen.
Oh no.
Yeah. Oh, they got robbed in Fort Providence.
I've heard of a lot of people having that happen to them.
Yeah.
On, these kinds of journeys. Especially when you're passing through communities or urban areas or whatever.
Yeah, because your trip, you would have done a lot of that. What's that like?
I was just, I was super, super careful all the time. But I, you know, I took some risks now and then, but ended up being super lucky. Like, you know, I heard of people traveling through that community in northern Saskatchewan, La Lush.
Yeah.
And, you know, one person had one of their packs stolen and another person had one of their packs stolen too.
Right.
And I zipped into the store there real quick.
Yeah.
But there were some construction guys like working in between the store and the shoreline.
Yeah.
And one of them knew someone who I'd met over in Manitoba. And I'm not sure how we made that connection. And I was like, oh, okay, I know your buddy. And hey, do you think if I just run into the store for about 5 minutes, would you be okay to watch my canoe? And he was like, oh yeah, sure, man. No problem.
Cool.
I know Gary and Joni McGuffin who wrote, I wish I could remember the title now.
Right.
They had their canoe stolen. They started further out in Quebec and had their canoe stolen in Montreal.
Really?
And like all their gear and stuff and had to have it all replaced.
Bummer.
Yeah.
did you do a similar trip to them? The same route, more or less?
Very similar. Yeah. So they went all the way to Tuck, but they started a little further out in Quebec.
Yeah.
And they followed a different route in the middle of the country. So I think it was where I took the Churchill. They took some other rivers and lakes and went into Lake Athabasca and paddled all of Lake Athabasca.
Yeah. Wow. I've always wanted to go up there. There's like huge sand dunes on Lake Athabasca, isn't there?
Yeah.
Yeah, it looks neat up there.
Yeah.
My buddy Dave Green, who I think you know or know of, he did a trip with Frank Wolf all through Lake Northern Alberta and through Lake Athabasca 2, maybe 3 summers ago.
Cool.
But yeah, I've always been interested in that part of the world. What camp were you and Frank Wolf at, by the way?
Oh, Camp Onondaga.
Yeah, cool.
Yeah.
And you did some trips with him?
Yeah, I did.
Cool.
Yeah.
He's like become, maybe he was famous at the time, but he's certainly famous now.
Yeah. I don't think he was probably the greatest fan of like me and my age cohort at that time, or at least my age cohort, because we were kind of like shitheads.
Hooligans. Yeah, hooligans. Well, you know, in camp, you were doing trips how long as with kids in camp?
That camp, we only really did like 5-day trips, 7-day trips.
So not super long. I feel like if you have a hooligan kid, like the best thing you can do is like send them on a month-long canoe trip. Yeah. Like they'll come back less hooligan-like.
Yeah. Well, that's something I found guiding trips for kids, was that as part of my outdoor recreation degree, I learned about like the group process, and you go through like storming and norming and then performing. That's when you're like kind of achieving at your very best.
Yeah.
So like the first little while you're storming, like things aren't working out optimally, but you're kind of doing a little bit of trial and error and figuring out, you know, one system that works better over another. Norming is kind of like adopting that system and getting used to it. And then performing is once you've got it all down, right?
Right.
And those camp trips, you know, those kids really only have it down by like the very end of the trip.
Sure, sure.
So, you know, you bring them back, and then you start out with a new group and you're kind of starting all over again. So
yeah.
I always appreciated when I was guiding trips, like we got to do 7- and 8-day trips sometimes, and those were my favorite.
Yeah.
Because we'd actually get into the performing, and like the last half of our trip would be, you know.
Right. It takes a few days before you're humming along.
Yeah.
It takes a while to get into canoe trip mode. You know, it's like you don't have all your systems down until a few days, and get like, you know, this trip I did this summer, we started literally the first thing we did was portage. We got like dropped off at Pike's Portage.
Okay.
And then portaged it. Like we hadn't put blades in the water.
Wow.
Which is like smarter people would have started at Artillery Lake, but we really wanted to do the portage because we thought it was like an important, it's like such a neat history, you know,
for sure.
But I will say starting with a portage is a real good way to get like fast track, getting all your systems in gear. You very quickly, you learn like the what's efficient and what's not, you know?
Yeah.
But man, it was a slog. I think we had 670 pounds of gear.
Wow.
Plus the canoes, plus 2 canoes. We lugged the whole thing over Pikes. Like we were, you're never heavier, you know. Like we hadn't even eaten a meal yet, and we were portaging over Pikes.
And so, where did you end up last summer?
We were trying to get to Bathurst Inlet.
Okay.
And maybe I won't spoil it on the podcast because the trip was filmed.
Okay.
Northern Scavenger, who I was telling you about before we were on air, they filmed the whole trip, and it's like part of a.
Okay.
It's like I don't know how many mini episodes they're making. I think 8 or something. 8 episode miniseries. First one just came out last week.
Cool.
So I guess anyone who listens to this show, I encourage them to go.
Where can I find it?
It's on YouTube.
Okay.
Yeah, Northern Scavenger is the channel. And the first episode, which was it's the first 3 days or 4 days of our trip. It's like mostly just Pike's Portage. It just came out last week. So I won't. I don't think it's any secret that we didn't make it to Bathurst Inlet.
Okay.
But I won't spoil Northern Scavenger's miniseries.
Sounds like
I'll tell you when we're offline. But yeah, we'll talk about it after. I'll tell you why we didn't make it. We ran into a few issues.
Yeah.
But an awesome trip.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What's your like? Lately, I've been interviewing so many people who like have been done trips up here, and I've been like selling the Barren Lands on this trip, on this podcast, because like I did a trip there, and Jody, who was on the show, she was the most recent guest, like had just did the Thelon, and we chatted about that. And, I haven't had like a lot of like Upper Canada guests on, but you're like originally from, you probably cut your teeth like canoeing Algonquin and all those places.
French like, River.
Like famous, famous. Yeah. That's like quintessential. Like the North is obviously classic and like so many, it's like a lot of like the great trips are up here, but I feel like a lot of the great trips are also down there. And just such a rich history, you know, on those, like the French and as you say, Temagami and Algonquin and that. I haven't like really done any paddling there. I grew up out east in the Maritimes, you know, like I feel like that's a part of the country I would love to do some paddling in.
For sure. Yeah. Yeah, that's beautiful. I would recommend Quetico.
Where's that?
Big Way too. It's in northwestern Ontario.
Like up Kenora area?
On the way to Kenora, so in between Thunder Bay and Kenora.
Okay.
And that's the, like a big provincial park that borders the U.S. border. And then they have the Boundary Waters canoe area on the American side. So like together it creates this like massive canoeing area. And Quetico is the, it is a park, so you have to get a permit and all that. But they stagger it, or they only let so many people in at a time because they want you to have a wilderness experience.
I respect that.
They keep it really, really quiet.
Yeah.
And they don't have signage up, like portages are taken care of and whatnot, but they don't have signs for you.
Right.
That's one of the funny things. If you go to a place like Algonquin Park, you know, you get to this lake and then you can see this massive yellow sign at the other end of the lake and you're like, oh, the portage is there, you know. So the mystery of finding the portage is kind of
It's like
not really there.
Kedgy,
yeah,
in Nova Scotia, which is like a beautiful park, but it's like it's like cheating, you know. All the portages are like these like beautiful manicured gravel trails. You can like wheel. People bring their like little carts and they like wheel their canoe, from lake to lake. Don't get me wrong, it's really nice. It's like a nice place to go paddle, and I love going there. But something about slogging through the trying to find the portage trail, or like being lucky that there is one, you know, you're just like slogging through the bush. Something about that too that I find, it's like suffering, but it's like a fun form of suffering.
Yeah, there's a funny story I could tell you about Kedgy, but maybe when we're done.
Sure. We got a few things to talk about offline. Yeah. You have a, I guess I'm switching gears, but you got a radio background too, don't you?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's cool. I'm an amateur. I love the radio. Like, I prefer the radio to watching television, but I'm like an amateur radio enthusiast, and the podcast is like, I guess, how I express that. But you're like a professional radio guy, right? Like, or semi-professional?
Semi-professional. I sort of fell into it. I was really into music at the time.
Yeah.
And I was a musician. I'm not really a musician anymore. But
do you take any instruments when you paddle?
No, but I've been thinking about it. Like, I made a flute.
We
not too many years ago, and I was thinking that would be tin, super cool to bring
along. I take the tin whistle.
Okay. Cool.
Like Celtic or Irish, like whistle.
Yeah.
It's great. It's a great paddling instrument. It's like weighs nothing.
Yeah.
Weighs nothing. You can like rip away on the whistle. It's good fun. Anyway, carry on.
Or something that's multi-purpose, like a flute that, you know, becomes part of a canoe shaft or something like that.
Yeah, that'd be awesome. Yeah.
But I forgot what we were talking
about. No, radio. Like, what's your radio background?
So I was really into music, and I was I went to two different universities, if you include travel study courses, three. I started in a program and just wasn't really feeling it at York University. And I stayed there, and I had an opportunity to get involved with community-based campus radio there and really enjoyed that. Became their technical director, then the station manager.
Cool.
Then I left. I went to Thunder Bay to do the outdoor rec program there at Lakehead University. And there they had a radio station that was online, which was kind of a new thing back then.
Yeah.
But they were trying to get an FM license. And no one there really had any direct experience with FM radio,
right?
And knew too much about it.
Mm-hmm.
So the guy who was running it was moving away, and they were looking for someone new. And there were other people interested, but I just got the sense that probably the station would be more successful in its first year broadcasting FM if there was someone who had experience at an FM station,
right,
running the show. So, and I thought, well, it'll be fun too. Why not? So I put my hat in the ring and yeah, I got the job and ran LU Radio as it became an FM, brand new FM station.
Cool. In
Thunder Bay.
Yeah, right on.
And then a guy who I worked with, who was our program director, eventually became the station manager there after me. And then a guy who I hired as a music director was station manager there for like, I don't know how many years, a really long time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And once you enter the FM space, it's all sorts of regulation you have to adhere to, and it becomes probably pretty serious, I would think.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to online. Online, you can do whatever you want, right? Like, no one tells you what you can do, but...
In community-based campus radio, you know, you're working with a lot of volunteers.
Yeah.
So you're managing volunteers, and then you got the people that want to do the night shift late at night. And, of course, you're not allowed to be intoxicated on the air. And you're right. Not supposed to be swearing on air. And they're just, you know, someone shows up like... all liquored up.
Yeah, in university, my buddy Jason was like he had the late night show on the CKDU, the Dalhousie radio station, and his big thing was to bring the boys down to the radio station and drink some beers. And you would have hated him if you were the station manager.
But yeah, we had some people that we had to kick off the air and take away their show.
No doubt.
Unfortunately.
This is my favorite part about the podcast, man. Just sipping beers and talking to people. It's like, although I don't think we don't say anything too egregious on here.
Yeah.
Man. Yeah. It's like I don't record any episodes of the Canadian Canoe Podcast where I'm not sipping on a beer, I don't think.
That's great.
Yeah. You know, that's cool. I love radio. I have a shortwave radio. And man, it's fun. It's like, you know, just random nights when I'm at home reading a book or something, I turn on the shortwave and tune in to see what you can get. Like the other night, it was like that night, like 5 or 6 weeks ago when the power went out, and it was like the town was pitch black, and I turned on the shortwave and I was tuning into like North Korean.
Oh, wow.
It was like symphony music being broadcast on like North Korean public radio. Huh. And it was like, just picture North Korean like symphony music. It's like out of a different era. It's like,
yeah.
And then between songs, like some North Korean guy comes in, but it's in English. North Korean public radio is in English.
What?
Yeah, they broadcast. I mean, maybe not all the time, but like that evening they were broadcasting in English. It's like it's like state propaganda.
Yeah.
And like the guy is like commentating in English, and then it's just so cool, man. Like tuning into all these radio stations from all over the world. And then there's like, it's like shortwave is great for, like communist governments. Like, the North Koreans are big into shortwave. The Cubans are big into shortwave. Like communist governments love shortwave radio. And then like radical religious radical religious, like cultish type people from the southern states also love shortwave radio.
The people who have like really fringe social media groups now.
Yeah.
Nowadays, you know, they used to use the shortwave radio.
At least some of them still do. There's like a rich, it's like, you know, like CBC doesn't have a shortwave station anymore. I think the BBC still does. But like, it's, that all these like fringe groups are still into it. And it's just so interesting to like tune in and see what's being broadcast out into the space, you know.
Have you ever had a shortwave radio that you could bring on a canoe trip?
Well, the one I have is battery. I could take it. I didn't take it on this most recent trip. If I was going solo, I would definitely take a radio. Did you take a radio on your trip?
No, but I brought an iPod with me.
Yeah.
Which was, that was back when they had like the spinning plate hard drive the iPod.
Yeah.
But I had a little solar panel.
Yeah.
But that really helped kind of cheer me up and get me like pepped up at the beginning of the day.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The my brother and I on this most recent trip we were on, we stayed in a tent together and we had a phone with some audiobooks on it and we were out for like 30 days and we were listening to this book called Salt, which was a good book about like the history of salt. But like every night we would like put it on and then we'd like immediately fall asleep. And then the next night we'd be like, okay, like how, trying to figure out like how far we had like, do you remember that part? Like we'd like inevitably we'd like, we came to realize we're falling asleep like 3 minutes after we like put it on. And like we'd, month long, we didn't get through the book. We only got through like the first like four chapters. Cause like, you know, something about falling asleep to like someone telling you a story. It's like instant, you know?
Yeah. That reminds me of van camping during the Fort Simpson flood. I was living over in Fort Simpson when that happened a few years ago.
Oh, you were there.
Yeah.
Man, those videos are crazy where there's just like, I guess for the listeners who don't know, Fort Simpson's on the Mackenzie and like the Mackenzie freezes solid in the winter and then it breaks up in the spring and all the ice gets carried downriver. But there's videos of like telephone poles on the bank and the water was really high and like ice chunks just like sawing off telephone poles like a lawnmower cutting grass. It's like, it was insane.
And Blackfeather, the guiding company, their whole like canoe fleet, like
got taken out,
taken out and like floating out in the Mackenzie River.
Really? Yeah. Did they recover them?
They recovered a good number of them, I think.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. I think a lot of people were hanging on to them. I knew at least one person who had one like float up into the yard and they were like, okay, well, I guess I got a canoe.
Salvage rights, man.
And then there was word going around that insurance, you know, paid for all of the canoes. So
people didn't feel bad.
They were up for grabs or something. But then I think someone from Blackfeather came to my friend's place who, you know, the friends who had the canoe float up into the yard and was like, oh, that's our canoe. Can we take it? They were like, oh, sure.
Right.
Yeah.
It's kind of hard to say no.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. Cool, man. I don't, maybe we'll sign off. Anything else to add? Any words of wisdom?
I don't know. Yeah. Just, I feel like I haven't done anything tremendously exciting paddling wise in recent years. So I'm
looking to be re-inspired.
I'm looking to like turn over a new leaf and like, be inspired by something, do something different.
It's River Quest, man. Let's do it. Let's get the, team NWT.
I've been in touch with, a fellow who's German who wants to leave from, I guess, Fort McPherson area and go up the Rat River and follow the Rat,
Bell,
Porcupine River, Yukon River trip. that'll eventually take you down to the Bering Sea.
That would be cool.
Which is something that I've wanted to do for a long time. I fantasized about it. When I finished my cross Canada trip, I was like, no, it can't be over. I really just want to spend 4 months or 3 months or however many months of the year out in the bush and make that a regular thing. Maybe someday I can go back and I can follow that route and go all the way out to the Bering
Sea. Then you would literally, that would be the full crossing of the continent if you did that.
Mm-hmm.
So when might this happen?
It could happen in the summer, but unfortunately, the guy who I'm looking at going with, apparently he crossed into northern Iraq. He's like a passionate traveler.
Mm.
And he was in northern Iraq at a particular point in time, and the U.S. government thinks he's a part of ISIS.
Oh shit, you definitely don't want that.
He applied for his visa and he got turned down, but or maybe he was right. just joking and saying that they think he's a part of ISIS
because this trip would require you to go into the States.
Yeah. Because we'd be crossing the border. I mean, I don't think anyone's gonna be there, but
no.
best to have the visa anyway, so
that'd be,
see
yeah,
how that works out. He's there's a mechanism to contest it.
Okay.
Or, you know, ask them to review it again, review the application again. So he's working on that now.
Yeah.
But, yeah, something I could always do alone at some point, too.
Well, given your history.
Yeah.
You know, this is how it happens. You, like, can't rely on anybody else, so
yeah,
here you are paddling alone.
But yeah, I mentioned the loneliness thing, like that was a really, really tough thing for me. Like, I don't think I got over it the first year that I was out there.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second year, I almost turned around, but I was going downstream on the Winnipeg River and I was like, I don't want to paddle upstream. Otherwise, I probably would have turned around.
Yeah.
And I just kept going. And then I was somewhere out on Lake Winnipeg, and there were, like, all kinds of gulls and pelicans all over the place. Lake Winnipeg is amazing for, like, huge congregations of pelicans on a point.
Yeah.
And, you know, I talked to the pelicans, and I went, you know, I'm not alone out here. I'm talking to all the animals, like the pelicans and the gulls, and, you know, I'm sharing the experience with them. And I guess I always had this feeling at the beginning, like, oh, well, if I have this experience and no one is there to share it with me, did it really happen?
Right.
You know, some sort of, like, questioning like that.
Did you, like, document it? Did you film it or take lots of photos?
That was right before everyone started doing HD, like a couple years before.
Yeah.
I have a little bit of video footage. I took lots of photos. I got some great photos. I'll have to show you sometime.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, take you through my photo album.
Yeah.
But
it's true. You were before the time of, like, filming it and putting it on YouTube, though.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause, yeah, you did this one in 2006 or something?
2006, 2007, 2008.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, the world's come a long way since then.
So, yeah, there was some aha moment that I had on Lake Winnipeg there, and I was like, no, it's all good. I'm not alone. There are animals here, and I'm having a good time. And
good.
It doesn't matter if anyone else is here to witness it or not. Yeah, haven't done too much solo stuff in recent years.
Yeah, it'd be hard, so. Man. It's funny, you know, it's like, I would agree with you. I would find it tough.
Yeah.
But then I had Jody Alderson on the show. She was the most recent guest, and she was on to for a few reasons, but I really wanted to, like, pick her brain. She did a 30-day solo trip down the Clark Thelon this past summer.
Uh-huh.
And she was like unfazed by it. I was like, man, it must be so hard being out there all alone. And she's like, no, like I loved it. Like it was great. Yeah. It was just like not what I was expecting. You know, she was like so into it. Whereas like I go, as I say, I go out for like a one night solo and I'm like ready
freaked
to come
out.
Yeah. Not freaked out. I'm very comfortable. I'm very comfortable like in my skill, like, confident in my skills. Not freaked out, just like. Just get kind of lonesome, like no one to talk to, no one to share the experience with.
Yeah,
you know, so it's not really my thing. I like to have a crew. It's fun to have a crew, and you're like all in it together. And it's just, like the other beauty of these trips, and we kind of, I think this is why I think it's so good for like kids and camp and stuff. Is like you become, it's like
camaraderie.
Camaraderie is like, amazing. You become like
relationship.
Yeah,
building.
You become like you go on a canoe trip with someone, and you're like best friends after. You know.
Yeah.
So, like, I love all that, whereas if you're alone, you don't really get any of that. And, you know, it's just the teamwork, all that, that whole component of, like, canoe tripping is really, really fun. If you're just by yourself, like, slogging day in and day out, it's, I don't know, it doesn't seem as fun. But
I think there's a certain kind of, like, resilience I've built up from doing it before.
Yeah.
And it helped me out during the pandemic because, when everything started for the most part in March 2020, I was living alone in Fort Simpson.
Right.
And, I didn't see anyone for months, like apart from going to the grocery store.
Yeah.
So it was almost like doing a solo canoe trip. I think other people were going a little bit more stir crazy than I was because we were in the same boat because I had done this thing where I was alone for a long period of time.
Yeah, it's true. It would definitely equip you in a way that most people aren't used to being. Most people are rarely alone, you know, like it's definitely a skill that you have that I'm sure a lot of people don't, you know? But I get it that you don't want to do too much more of it. This trip was all, there was a bit of advocacy associated with it, right?
Like,
maybe touch
on
that.
So, it was actually when I was planning the trip as part of that exposition management course at Lakehead University. We read something that brought up the idea of attaching some sort of purpose to the expedition.
Yeah.
And at that time, I was reading a lot about water-related environmental issues.
Yeah.
And, like, just feeling really concerned about them. And especially since, as paddlers, we spend so much time in the water, right?
Yeah.
And then a lot of us fish and, depend on other things. Depend on clean drinking water out there. And so maybe that's part of the reason I felt so passionately about them. But, I think it was a phase that I was going through at that point in time. But a lot of it, you know, I still believe in today, certainly. I was trying to raise awareness about water related environmental issues across the country.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of trying to send people a message that, you know, we should protect our water resources. Protect them from commodification, pollution, and invasive species.
Yeah, we're lucky in Canada to have amazing water resources.
Mm-hmm.
You go to other parts of the world, like, man, you know, can't drink any of the water.
So that was, like, that was a big part of what I was doing too. And I think that's part of the reason why it made sense to extend the trip into 3 years rather than two, because there was a lot of work on the side to do related to that.
Right.
And I was meeting a lot of environmental NGOs along the way, but like talking to people who fish the lakes or just like recreated in the area, and tried to gather information from everyone about, you know, different water related environmental issues across the country, which was super interesting. And then I do like media interviews in different towns or cities that I pass through, and then they'd write an article about me, and sometimes they'd reference something that was happening the local area related to water.
Not a lot of people who've paddled across the, like, in obviously once upon a time it was a thing, but in recent, in like this era, there's not a lot of people who've paddled across the country, you know? So like, for sure you could, you can like develop, or like the local media would be something to worth writing about when you paddle through town, I would think.
For sure.
Do you know anyone else who's paddled across Canada?
I do. Yeah. There was a guy who was doing it at the same time as me.
Okay.
But he did it in different stretches and went different directions, like sort of to take advantage of the downstream run a little bit.
Yes.
Jay Morrison, and then some friends of mine had done it like right before I did it. Evelisa McIlfatrick and Marianne Glazer.
Yeah.
And they did a similar thing where they kind of jumped around a little bit, but I really wanted to start at one side and like go
and to the other
side and like see it all, see the whole progression in that way.
Yeah, no, that's neat.
Yeah.
The only other person I know who's done it is Bert Terhart, who's been on the show, but he went west to east, and I think he would think you're crazy not to go west to east. Like,
yeah,
but he did it in the summer. So he, I think,
he was saying his was 4,000 kilometers. You know, I still haven't gone through all my journals and like added up every single, like, this day was 40 kilometers.
Right.
Put it all together. But, yeah, somewhere around a little over 8,000 kilometers.
Oh, yeah, really? His route was different. You went, in addition to going west, east to west, you went north, south to north, whereas he basically just stayed on the south. Like, he didn't go north like you did.
But I know of quite a few people who've started around Rocky Mountain House.
Yeah.
And then they just kind of run east in here.
Yeah. Yeah, because you can go so far on downriver when you go west to east. Like, you don't actually,
it's mostly downstream.
Really, it's all downstream, really, except for like the French River, basically.
Little stretches.
Little stretches.
Yeah.
So, and that's why he was convinced that's the only way to do it, is because he just never make it if you go east to west in one summer. But he was trying to do it in one summer, whereas you took three, so that makes sense.
But yeah, that was, meeting with all those people along the way was like super interesting, but I'm not as keen to do that sort of expedition again because it's just so much more work. I'd rather just go out and have a good time and like do a great trip.
But, yeah.
I had some super interesting experiences when I was in Fort McMurray. So I paddled through, you know, the heart of the
what happened?
And I think I've thought of the right way to present this without like getting anyone into trouble.
Right.
Years ago, I had someone from the Toronto Star want to run a story that was like a version of this story, and I said no. because I might be getting someone in trouble, but I think I thought of the right way to present it. I had quite a few tours of different oil sands operations up there, okay, with like different characters.
Yeah.
And all really good people, like amazingly kind, generous, friendly people. I remember having one tour where, and I won't say what these people's jobs were, but the one fellow, was, telling me how, you know, the tailings ponds, like, we follow the specs that the engineers give us. The engineers know what they're doing. So, you know, as long as we build them the spec, we're doing our job, and we know the tailings ponds are never going to leak.
Yeah.
Well, I think it was that summer it came out that, you know, there were like millions of liters of water per day leaching out of that tailings pond, like straight into the Athabasca River.
Yeah.
I had another tour, and at a different operation, and I remember this guy was like, well, you know, I kind of came here because I could make a living for my family.
Yeah.
But like, look at this. Showed me like some areas that were supposedly being reclaimed. Like, is this ever going to be anything like it originally was in terms of a forest ecosystem? Like, no. And I visited Syncrude, and they have this lake that they showcase.
Yeah.
And it's like effluent water that they've treated that is, you know, supposed to be like drinking water quality. You could just go up and like dip your cup in there and drink right out of
You're
it.
You're not going to pay me any
but
money to
no
do that.
No one who works there will do that.
No.
Yeah. So, yeah, there are a lot of super interesting experiences.
I worked with this guy once who was in the marine industry, and his job was to like, there was these, they weren't like, when I say boat, I don't mean like a little tin boat with an outboard. I mean like a ship. It was like a small ship, but like a tugboat. Like it had a full get cabin and like galley on it. And his job was to like bob around in the tailings ponds in this ship and like scare away migratory birds that would land in the tailings pond. But this like literally spent his days floating around in this like effluent pond that's like evaporating off all this like gases, I'm sure, and breathing it in. I was like, oh my god, what a way to live, man.
Yeah,
you know, it's just like, yeah, it's insane. Like, you wonder living here in Yellowknife, you know, it's like all that stuff flows down to the Great Slave Lake. Like, it's all here, you know? And you always, like, even just this week, there was some story about undisclosed leaching into the Athabasca River, which then finds its way here, you know? It's like,
yeah,
this is where it's all going.
Yeah.
It's like, this can't be good. It can't be good.
I just kind of hope that most of it, like, keeps going along that south shore of Great Slave Lake to the Mackenzie.
Which is probably what happens. Yeah.
Yeah.
But even then, it's like no good there, you know?
Yeah. So, yeah, that's all that is pretty, can be pretty sad if you think about it in a certain context.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. But, yeah, paddling through that whole area with all the cannons. So they have the tailings ponds, and they're trying to keep the birds from landing on the tailings ponds because,
right,
you know, they'll get sick and die.
And they're shooting off cannons.
So they're, you know, these cannons are going off, and it sounds like, you know, artillery from a war or something like that every few minutes. And so I remember a few days of camping along the Athabasca River, and it felt like I was in some kind of Vietnam War movie or something like that.
Yeah, like Apocalypse Now, like going up the river. Crazy.
Yeah.
All right, Seth. Thanks for coming on the show. I got to sign off here.
Yeah, and, well, thanks for having me.
No, it's a pleasure. You got a cool story, so it's always fun to, you know, hang out with paddlers, especially in a wall tent. But it's getting cold in here, and the fire's about to go out, so.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks again.
Yeah.
We'll see you around.
Sounds good.
Okay, bye.
Cheers.